Welcome to Family Business Radio, a new show on Business Radio X. I'm the producer, Lee Cantor, and we have our gorgeous hostesses, Meredith Moore and Pat Romboletti, in the studio with me. Ladies, why don't you share with our audience why you two chose to start a show on family business?
Lee, we are so happy to be here. And this subject and this topic is very near and dear to both of our hearts. I wanted to be a part of this project because I work with a number of family-owned businesses, and I'm seeing a consistent number of issues that seem to be the same across the board. And working with some of these families on estate planning and really trying to come up with some sort of succession plan so that they can pass the business on to another family member or to a key employee tends to come up quite a bit. Also, a lot of times I'm seeing issues with how do you treat a family member that's involved with the business, but even if you have a child that's outside the business, how do you divide the estate, if you will, if you're giving the business to the child active there, but then there's one that's not. So how do you deal with this? Also, we really wanted to try to help create be a pivotal resource and create a community for this family business owner market here in the Southeast.
Thanks, Meredith. I'm equally excited. I spent the first 15 years of my life working in family businesses, so I got to see it very firsthand, and then went to the other side and worked somewhat in corporate America. And then when I launched my Sage Executive Search firm, I decided that I would focus on family businesses, and it has been immensely rewarding. It's a group that uses our services at really critical phases of their development. It might be because they don't have another generation ready to take the arms of the company, so they need to bring in somebody for an interim period of time until that next generation is ready. Or increasingly these days, they don't have a next generation that wants to take the business, so they need to bring in a CEO, COO to help to run the business and fill in that gap where the family would have been. And then lastly, they typically will bring in a senior executive when they're trying to really take the business to the next level, increase value, and demonstrate its viability without the family involved, so that when they do decide to sell, they have really created value. So we have filled that niche, and it's wonderful because you change lives all the way around the board when you work in that environment. So it's been really great. Meredith, I think some of our listeners don't necessarily have all of the scope of the impact that a family business has on our economy, and I know you have some statistics to share on that.
Absolutely, and to your point, Pat, that's exactly right. Economically, I think a lot of people don't realize the true impact that family-owned business does have in our economy. And what I wanted to do was review some statistics from the Cox Family Business Center at Kennesaw State University under the direction of Joe Astrachan, and I wanted to review some of these statistics to really speak to this point. First, 80% of the world's businesses are family-owned. That's 80%.
Huge.
Yep. Family-run businesses account for more than half of the nation's gross domestic product, over half. Nearly 35% of family-owned businesses are Fortune 500 and other large companies such as Ford, Walmart, Lowe's, and IKEA are some of these other companies. Approximately 60% of all public companies in the U.S. are family-controlled. Family-owned businesses account for 60% of total U.S. employment, 78% of new jobs, and 65% of all wages paid out there right now. Many family businesses were started after World War II, so you're looking at a very specific generation when a lot of these began. More than 25% of family firms expect the next CEO to be a woman, which really speaks to the two of us being female co-hosts. More than 30% of all family-owned businesses survive into the second generation, and 30% is a very low number if you take into account the success that business may have. So only 30% are being passed on to the next generation.
So, you know, we really feel like if we can create a community that can have people understand this huge impact and contribution. And our show is going forward, feature kind of three categories. We will have family business owners on. They will be telling their story. In some instances, they will still be running the business, and they'll be sharing with us the challenges and how they're overcoming them. In some instances, they will have already sold the family business and will provide a lot of great insight so that people can avoid some of the pitfalls that in some instances they have incurred. But there's a couple of other constituencies that we know to be critical. One of those is the, in many instances where they have brought in outside executives who are not family members, and we'll be sharing the microphone with some of them to tell a little bit about that experience and how to really leverage that talent. And then lastly, represented by one of our guests today, is the professional and trusted advisor. The family business thrives by having outside advisors that can bring best practices, bring their knowledge and expertise to bear with the family business, and many, like Meredith and I, specializing in that, and like our guest today. So that is really what you will see. And when we say create a community, we really are inviting you to participate, to go to our website, which we'll give the address at the end. And if you are a family business owner and want to be on our show, you'll see a lot of information there about that. But today, I want to welcome our guest. And, you know, actually, numerous family businesses, the citizens of Georgia, the members of Sugarloaf United Methodist Church in Gwinnett County, have all benefited from the knowledge, skill, and generosity of our guest today, John Dillard, CPA and founder of His CPA. And we've already stated that Family Business Radio is here to provide insights to make your family business successful and make it thrive. And one of the ingredients of a thriving business is financial fitness. And John comes to us today with more than 30 years' experience as a trusted advisor in the role of CPA with a dedication to helping businesses thrive. You know, Meredith and I are honored to have John on our premier show, but John's no stranger to honors. He's an honor graduate with an accounting degree from Georgia State University. He's received another honor that is very relevant to our discussion today, that of Accounting Advocate of the Year Award for his contribution to the business community. And since we'll be taking a more expansive look at the role of the CPA as your partner and your advocate today, what better person to speak to that topic than an honoree in that category? And John's accounting credentials and experience are without question, but he's also found time to make a much bigger impact through community involvement, assisting Georgia State Supreme Court overturning the Georgia Trade Secrets Act of 1990, and we might have a moment for him to share some insight on that today. Changed the Georgia state law by passage of the Crime Victims Act of 2005, which requires people committing major crimes against children to pay for their medical and counseling care. In short, John has a passion for making a difference in everything he does. When he's not spending time with his wife and two teenage children, John is a committed member of Sugarloaf United Methodist Church. And another distinction, an author of Christian fiction. He's been honored there, too, as one of 90 nominated authors for the 45th Annual Georgia Author of the Year. And then just one last distinction to mention. He's a native of Atlanta, and given the melting pot that Atlanta has become, that is indeed one more honor. So welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yeah.
Well, John, you know, we were talking a little bit, and we stated that the trusted advisor is really – In the world of family business, it's someone that really focuses on the segment and understands all the nuances. Have you found this to be true?
Well, as a CPA, one of the things I like to compare myself to is kind of the definition of a CPA is a little bit different than what I would consider an auditor. An auditor has to go in after the fact and interpret things that have already occurred. It's almost like an army person checking the casualties after they've occurred. As a CPA, I think we're in charge and responsible for being proactive, to anticipating the future, to thinking ahead, to helping small business owners and family business owners avoid the potholes in life. And one of the things that I guess I've learned along those lines is, and one of the big failings that I see sometimes in the thinking ahead issue, is business owners frequently will use a tax service or a bookkeeping service rather than a CPA. I encourage all family business owners to use a CPA who's got talent and expertise in the running of a business rather than just a tax preparer. Mm-hmm. Often I sit down with business owners and I sit down where a tax preparer rather than someone who cares about that individual will sit down with them. You see tax returns that where deductions are missed, insight was forgotten, and there's no carryover of good and consistent strategic long-term thinking.
Mm. Let's start with some of the basics. In terms of family-owned businesses, do you think there are any special considerations that the business owner needs to consider when selecting a CPA? And does anything make their selection unique or different, perhaps, than the average business owner out there?
Well, for me, one of the things that I believe that a CPA can bring to the table, if they do have that credential, is the ability and past expertise of having served as a controller or chief financial officer for a business. In my early days as a CPA working for Touche Ross, one of the Big Eight at that point, I guess I'm dating myself age-wise, but one of the things I've learned over the years, it's much easier to give advice than it is to implement it. Having worked on the inside of companies as an accounting manager, controller, CFO, COO, you learn over the years that that having that wisdom and insight to be able to contemplate the future, to establish policy, to make appropriate changes when necessary. But to me, I think one of the biggest things that that experience helps bring to the table in having worked with family businesses is empathy. Mm. It's an understanding. Mm. For individuals and advisors that give advice and that don't understand and don't put themselves in the client's shoes and don't evaluate advice solely from the client perspective, I think they're missing an opportunity to make a difference in someone's life. Mm-hmm. I believe all of us should practice the golden rule when we serve others, is how would I want to be served? Mm-hmm. And if I practice the way that I want to be served, that I'm best suited and best armed to be able to anticipate what that person needs rather than throw it at them a litany of menu items that make no sense to a client.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the key roles do you think a CPA should play in supporting the family business owner? I mean, what key things?
For me, a CPA in terms of serving the family business is like an ER. We're like the ER. We're the emergency room for the family business owner. If you're about to go out and make a major decision, you're about to buy a business, sell a business, add a partner, delete a partner, add a retirement plan, add a new business segment, buy a building, when you're about to do those major substantial things, those are the times you need to pick up the phone and call and make a phone call to your CPA. And whether you follow that CPA's advice to the letter or not, you have the opportunity, the added insight that will give you the ability to make a better decision. To answer your question more specifically and directly, I think a CPA who's seasoned in serving family businesses should essentially be a virtual controller and a virtual CFO. Mm-hmm. The better client relationships that I've seen work over time are when those partners and when those business owners and those mom-and-pop situations, whether you're doing $100,000 or $10 million in revenue, for those shops where the business owner is keenly aware and keenly sensitive to knowing that this is out of the ordinary. And for those business owners that pick up the phone and call for things that are out of the ordinary, you'll find that they make better financial, short-term, and long-term decisions, as well as mitigating the tax bill in the interim.
Mm-hmm. What can the family business owner do to best partner with their CPA? What can they make sure that they have in order or have prepared to make your life easier or the CPA's job easier?
I'd like to share a brief example of something that happened with me. It's a little bit off tenor, but I didn't go to the dentist for several years. The dentist was there every single day. And when I didn't go to the dentist for several years, when I finally went back, I had to pay the price. I had lots of overhaul work and lots of catch-up work to do. I think the key thing to get your CPA involved, I alluded to earlier, but I'll emphasize again now, is to call your CPA often, call them when things are out of the ordinary, call them when things are varying substantially from what is normally going on. And it gets back to that whole thing of keep it simple. Mm-hmm. But at the same point in time, when things get complex and things get a little out of the ordinary, pick up the phone and don't be afraid. And know that no question is truly insignificant. Mm-hmm. Very seldom, maybe once every 5-10 years, do I have a client call with a question that I truly feel like is insignificant and I shouldn't have. Mm-hmm. 99% times out of 100, the questions are right on target. and dramatic changes can be made in terms of those calls. Just recently, for example, and this happens from time to time, we have clients who will call a looking data partner, and they want to issue stock day one and give a bonus incentive or a condition incentive that they have to achieve after they come to work. Mm-hmm. One of the neat things for small business owners is to establish that incentive beforehand. Mm-hmm. And establishing that incentive beforehand, make that an attainment requirement before issuing stock. It's a small tweak, but it's substantial. Mm-hmm.
Do you find that creating some of those incentives are just as relevant with family-owned business if, say, they're bringing in a child into the business that they want to make their way? Or what are your thoughts in terms of incentives and programs like that?
I believe, and I've watched it in many situations, I believe when bringing a child into a business, you really have two things first to evaluate. One, is the child going to be a key player or a minor player? Because mm-hmm. those are two totally different answers. If they're a minor player, then you can maintain a lot of the semblance of the parent-child relationship and maintain the integrity of that parent-child relationship. However, if they're coming in as a key player, the relationship predominantly has to transcend during the workday to a business relationship, not a parent-child. I think in bringing a child on to be a key player, there does need to be a little bit more coddling than perhaps you would with a partner mm-hmm. That's an independent individual. But I do think that all the keys and the integrities, and in fact, with all situations, adding new partners, I think there's the essentialness of adding a shareholder agreement before you actually add a partner. Mm-hmm. What I always love telling people that are about to add a partner is all partnerships end.
Yeah.
They will. Mm-hmm. Somebody will die, somebody will quit, somebody will leave. Mm-hmm. All partnerships will end. Knowing all partnerships will end, the key is, while everybody's still in agreement, and before stock is issued, mm-hmm. is to draft a shareholder agreement that we all can live with.
How often do you think the family-owned business should be revisiting that shareholder agreement?
If it's well drafted and things are relatively consistent, maybe once every 5 to 10 years.
Mm-hmm. I know I see in my practice a lot of times where those get outdated very quickly as revenues increase. And so it sounds like you're seeing that as well, but that five-year mark is, or are you looking at a specific revenue or sales percentage that they should be up before they revisit? Or what are some of the triggers that would lead them to revisit some of that planning?
Well, first off, I'll throw out in situations where we've been involved with circumstances such as you're referring to, is often we've walked into situations and environments where the shareholder agreements, quite honestly, were not workable, not doable, mm-hmm. not efficient, not effective, not productive. In essence, they were trash. It saves a lot of time just telling the truth.
We're all about it over around here.
But often I've seen situations where the initial agreement has to be drafted and changed. The key thing beyond that, where you're going to see agreements need to be changed, is where you have had rapid growth and estate planning issues mm-hmm. and succession business issues become more into play as the business matures and evolves.
Yeah. It sounds like I'm just listening to you, and it's clear that you're involved with your clients well beyond just that April 15th deadline that a lot of people pick up the phone and call their accountant. And go back to this family issue, because how often, John, do you have the whole family come in or meet with the whole family? There's a lot of competing interests from different age brackets. So certainly the older generation has one interest in how those, not just the agreements are structured, but all of the financial ramifications, versus the younger generation who might be looking to buy their first home, might be looking for some liquidity, might be looking, you're talking about buying buildings, looking at that real estate and figuring out how to leverage it. Do you wind up kind of quarterbacking when you talk about the CFO for the family, both from the business side and the personal side?
I'm going to answer that several different ways mm-hmm. and vaguely on purpose.
Okay.
For example, one of my dearest friends had a business where all four siblings worked in the business and worked successfully for 20, 25 years. Mm-hmm. They had no succession planning. They weren't a client of mine. Mm-hmm. They had no succession planning and, to my knowledge, had no shareholder agreement. Mm-hmm. Although they'd worked together successfully for 20 to 25 years, when Dad passed – all of a sudden, the four siblings who've been able to work together for 20, 25 years no longer could work together. What I have witnessed predominantly in terms of that succession issue is you really have two or three key points going on. First off is the issue of control.
Mm-hmm.
Who is going to make the decisions? I have seen situations where in an effort to divest stock from the parents down to the children, that we've had individuals who did not mind owning a minority of the company, but yet they owned all of the voting stock, so they retained all of the decision-making ability.
Right.
So we've been able to do that very successfully in different situations where the kids would actually own and the non-voting people that that we intentionally left out of the voting process owned 90% of the stock.
Excellent.
But the owners would then retain and wanted to retain the control issue.
Mm-hmm.
And getting back to the control issue is, I guess, that second tenet of response to your question. The key issue on the control issue is when does that pendulum shift?
Right.
Until then, let's be honest, I hate to go back to the adage, he who has a goal makes the rules.
Right.
But in a small business, it's true.
Mm-hmm.
51% ownership is king, or queen, as you ladies would say.
Yes, we would.
But with that control and with that king and with that ownership, that is the key precipitating point. And I have seen small businesses when that that's a difficult word for me. But when that pendulum shifts, and the new business owner achieves control as they ultimately make the decisions. In small businesses, typically I don't see and probably won't see a quorum process where all parties agree.
Right.
It's typically a stock ownership issue.
Right. Is it ideal? What's the ideal situation for you? You take on a new client, and there's three sons and a daughter working in the business, and the husband and wife, and you get a call from one person. What's ideal for you? Are you encouraging them to come in to consult together at points in time, and what makes that work best?
Every situation is unique. What works best is for the key decision-making people to be involved at every step of the way. When it's a husband-wife team and both people are heavily involved running the business, both people need to be at all important meetings. That doesn't need to mean that they need to be at all meetings, all important meetings, all strategic meetings. One of the things that I often see business owners fail on is LLCs, for example, have become very much in vogue. LLCs are going to pay more taxes than S-corporations, for example. I see a lot of business owners failing to make proper tax selections. One of the things I would encourage all business owners toward that decision-making process, in fact, I had one of my clients several years ago insisted that he would bring on the tax attorney to evaluate my work because the tax attorney was certain he could find more deductions. I was not threatened by that because I knew what I was doing.
Right.
But a lot of CPAs, and especially the bookkeeping services, might not be finding every legal deduction for a business owner. And I encourage all business owners, even my own clients, to get a second opinion, to make sure that you're headed down the right path. Find seasoned and quality help. But getting back to, to the nature of your question, I think every situation the small business owner in terms of the decision is different. Often I've seen the wife or the husband take predominant lead in making the financial decisions, whereas the other was predominantly the breadwinner or the rainmaker, if you will.
Right.
Tell me this, John. Are you seeing a lot of situations where the stock ownership, i.e. the control, doesn't line up with, how about this, the control element doesn't line up with who's receiving the majority of the dividends or the profits, meaning somebody might have B shares where they don't have necessarily any voting rights, but they're receiving a portion of those profits. Are you seeing situations where those don't always line up? And can you speak to some of the dynamics in businesses like that?
I wish I could. The majority of situations where I see and the majority of situations where I encourage clients is to maintain control. Whether you're dealing with a husband, wife, multiple partners, a family business with the children and or nieces, nephews, cousins, uncles involved, let's face it, when you're running a business, you have to have the ability to respond quickly to changing dynamics. We've seen that in our own economy over the last couple of years in the United States.
Sure.
We've seen it throughout the small business community with the jobless rate and pending inflation rates, money concerns, crunch concerns, financing concerns. But to me, for a small business to run effectively, you have to have a strong central leader. And I think it needs to be a dynamic to which quick and effective and efficient and intelligent and rational decisions can be made, which aren't going to be made necessarily by quorum. Mm-hmm. That assumes, and you pray for, and you hope to get an intelligent, reasonable business owner, because that intelligent, reasonable business owner is going to seek the advice and counsel of people like the three of us to help guide and direct those individuals. But in all candor, I've seen very few situations where the control has been limited by where the majority of the stock has been owned by a person owned. Can I try again?
Yeah.
In all candor, I would never encourage and would never gleefully support somebody taking a minority interest that's a majority decision maker.
Okay.
It's a recipe for disaster.
In terms of succession, are there any bits, little tax bits or anything when mom and dad might be passing the business down to a daughter or a son from a tax planning perspective? Are there any words of wisdom that you might have in regards to that?
Two or three big issues I guess I would hit on. One is to know what your business is worth, which would involve getting a business valuation or having some sort of sensible, reasonable, defendable basis for doing so. Tax law has long allowed any individual to give up to a certain dollar amount. I believe this year it's either $11,000 or $12,000 to as many people as you want. And if you do consensual gifting and you're married and then your child is also married, then each of you could give to each spouse stock and stock ownership. So one of the ways to transfer ownership is going to be through gifting. Another way to transfer ownership is going to be through compensation, determining a portion of the value of the business you desire to give away and giving that out over time. Both the gifting and the valuation issues, absent a purchase, I would encourage business owners to do over a period of time. Okay. I would not encourage somebody to do it in any one fell swoop for a year. I would let the sibling or the other partner or the child that's not been the runner in the past and not been running the business in the past to have time to grow into the maturity of running the business and to maintaining the integrity and the profitability of the business as it's achieved. To accomplish all of what I just talked about, I think the best absolute person is an estate planning or a tax attorney.
Mm-hmm. What are you seeing, too, in terms of any kids or siblings or something that aren't involved in the business in addressing passing down a business to the next generation? I mean, how typically do you see people dealing with family members outside the business? Do you see what I'm talking about?
I understand your question totally. To me, I think for my client base, again, as y'all are so kind in your intro, I've been a CPA for almost 30 years. In my experience, most of the businesses today, if I were to take a fell swoop and evaluate it, we at any given time, we have about 100 business clients and have served over the year thousands.
Right.
I would suspect that most family businesses, in terms of that hand down, will not succeed in handing down that business to the next generation.
Well, and that speaks to that statistic we were talking about, only 30% being passed down. So that's been obviously your experience as well.
And I think the 30% is buoyed by the fact that some of those are the larger businesses that have been handed down.
Right.
For clients with revenue bases, especially below $5 and $10 million of revenue, I would imagine most of those businesses are going to decease at the day that the owner stops working.
Okay.
At any given time, for example, today I have 100 businesses. I would have to guess maybe 2 to 3 of those would survive.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, sometimes our listeners learn best by understanding what some of your clients came to you a little too late, and you had to do triage, kind of like you talked about the dentist. Is there any theme there? Any typical? My experience working with family businesses in the human resources side is that they tend to hold on and kind of hope something improves and kind of have a lot of, you know, they're risk takers, so they keep the faith, and sometimes they keep it too long, and then they have to make a drastic change. And I'm assuming that sometimes comes in your world in terms of not consulting, having consulted with you. We touched on some, but any specific examples where somebody came to you and, you know, you kind of had to fix things? You know, a lot of people say, well, anything can be fixed, but it can be fixed at a price. So,
I'll bring a couple of situations I can think of off the top of my head, and some of them are just tax related.
Mm-hmm.
We do a fair amount of IRS representation work, offers, and compromise. And I love telling my clients, follow my advice, we'll never have tax problems.
Mm-hmm.
We've never had to go back and fix a major tax problem for a client that's followed our advice. It's just not going to happen. It's just not going to occur.
Right.
And I said, for clients that followed my advice.
Right. I heard the caveat.
I have had some clients that had not followed my advice. We did have some major tax problems.
Right.
But if they'll be in tune with their CPA, they can avoid those dilemmas. Mm-hmm. Frequently, what I see in terms of creating caveats, and I go back to some of my earlier advice, is I often see business owners use a bookkeeping or an accounting service.
Yeah.
I think they're great for bookkeeping.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're great for maybe the retail user that's got a home, mm-hmm. And needs to get their tax return done, and all they have is mortgage interest.
Right.
But I see a lot of returns for small business owners, and helped one through the process recently, that for about $1,000 of fees, we found about $10,000 of refunds that didn't previously exist.
Mm-hmm.
We found depreciation that had not been recorded on prior returns or carried forward.
Mm-hmm.
We found business transactions that had not been recorded properly.
Mm-hmm.
We found S elections that had not been made for both LLCs and or C corporations.
Mm-hmm.
We found errors in returns where people had filed returns as S corporations thinking they were when no S election was ever filed and or received.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's a lot of errors that occur because of that failure to be preemptive.
Mm-hmm.
We've all heard it. An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
Right.
I think it's that extra 10% that we try to focus on with all of our clients that is the difference between gold-plating our service back to our clients,
mm-hmm.
and or giving mediocre service.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as a CPA, I think we're all charged, whether we all do it or not, that's a different issue. But I think as a CPA, we're all charged to look beyond, to look ahead.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, my thought process constantly remains, I may be working on all day on past tax returns,
mm-hmm.
but I'm thinking about, how does this past tax return affect the future?
Uh-huh.
What can I do to make a difference for this person for next year, so when they come in here, so we have a better end result?
Right.
To dovetail on my question about reviewing the operations agreement, how often should a family-owned business get their business valued again? How often should that occur? Should it be a sales increase trigger, or how would you address that?
Sorry for the dead space.
Doo-doo.
To me, that's a very difficult answer, and I'd be happy to approach it. But if things are relatively consistent, if, for example, you have a firm that's doing $200,000 a year and adding $100,000 a year and it's been doing that for 10 years, there's probably going to need to update it, period.
Right.
If you have things that are rapidly changing and or you have a shareholder agreement, for example, one of our client situations, I think off the top of my head, we have a client situation where it's required as part of their shareholder agreement to determine an annual value. That annual value is important for two reasons. If one of his partners leaves, he needs to determine the value that that person will be paid out at, as well, if something were to happen to him, mm-hmm. it's the valuation at which his family would be paid out at. So to answer your question, it would really vary by situation.
Mm-hmm.
But if things are rapidly changing, I would suggest at least every other year. If they're changing extremely rapidly, perhaps every year.
You know, I've seen a lot of great programs in the last year about how to take advantage of the current economy. There's also been certainly a lot of news about the gloom and doom. But, you know, in any dip in the economy, there's opportunity. And I know from my experience that many family-owned businesses have a heavy commitment in real estate. They tend to have manufacturing facilities, et cetera. Are there any opportunities for a family business right now that you've seen, any advice that you're giving your clients Given the downturn, is there an upside available to them?
Well, there's three little checkpoints that I'd like to kind of bring up mm-hmm. to answer that question. Mm-hmm. One is always live below your means.
Mm-hmm.
You can't take advantage of opportunities mm-hmm. if you're stretched to the gills.
Okay.
What I always love telling my clients is all of us have fire insurance on our house, but none of us necessarily, hopefully today, right now as we are talking, have a fire.
Mm-hmm.
But not a lot of us have fire insurance and financial insurance to protect our finances.
Mm-hmm.
There's three ways I think we can protect our finances. One is to have a cushion.
Mm-hmm.
Two is to have an equity line on our home.
Mm-hmm.
And the three is to have those margins so that we live below our means. Hiccups in our life will occur. And it's not a question of if they will occur. It's like I said earlier, all partnerships eventually end. Financial hiccups will occur. And for example, in my opinion, the majority of the reason for the hiccup in the American economy was because nobody had margins.
Right.
If people had margins, the hiccup would have been a downtick, not a disaster.
Mm-hmm.
I have seen circumstances where, for example, one of the churches I'm familiar with wanted to do a $12 million addition. And they couldn't get everything they wanted for $12 million, but because they lived within their margins, because they limited their debt, because of the turn in the economy, they were able to go back and get that same $12 million addition that they didn't get everything they want for $10 million and get everything they want.
Excellent. Mm-hmm.
A prudent business owner, investor, advisor, individual, taxpayer is not going to feel a huge change in the economy if they're living within their margins, living below their means. And part of that is to work with financial advisors such as yourselves to get regular checkups to see where you're at.
Mm-hmm.
And to know your, what I will call your checkpoints.
Mm-hmm.
One of the worst things I think can happen to us as a country, as well as can happen to us as individuals, is to get all the debt we can that would be given to us.
Right.
For example, I think a lot of us could go out and get debt for the hundreds of thousands of dollars today, just if we asked for it.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a horrible, horrible thing to do.
Right.
I think often when we're evaluating, creating those margins, creating those checkpoints, and what I always love telling my clients is, for example, I don't care if my client buys a Ferrari. Just write a check for it.
Yeah.
If you can't write a check for it, you probably can't afford it.
Mm-hmm.
Luxury items, those key items, those lifestyle choices, those second homes, buying the bigger home before you're ready.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen homes, for example, that were purchased, $700,000 homes with $100,000 down. A lot of people would say they could get a loan, they could afford it. I would argue they couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
I would suggest for a $700,000 home, if you didn't put at least half down, you can't afford it.
Oh.
You shouldn't be there.
Mm-hmm. Another quick question. In terms of family business, what are you seeing? How would potential taxable estates, in terms of estate tax, if the family business owner, if dad died, what kind of impact are you seeing that potentially having on a family business?
I think your real downtick is going to be that the business may have to be sold to fund the estate tax.
And so that would be on the onus of the other family members to sell their shares of stock to an outsider, or?
It may be to an outsider, sell the business in toto. And worse yet, it could be that they'll be stuck with the tax. The business is a result of poor planning, lack of succession planning, lack of thinking about how to pass that business down to the next generation, lack of grooming for a successor may result in a tax bill and a failed business to boot.
And what, if you could speak a little bit about how estate taxes work, with what's going to be happening with the tax code, how much is the business, how much can it be worth so that they can pass that down without having to pay Uncle Sam upon death?
I wasn't prepared for that question.
Sorry.
I'm not an estate person or a planner, and you probably know that better than I do. But there is a modicum of an amount. I believe it's around, and you help me out with the amount. I really don't recall off the top of my head. 2 to 3 million?
Yeah, I think it's around that, 3.5-ish.
Okay.
I don't know. But
any business, for example, let's say it's, for example, sake of argument, 3 million, and you have a business that's valued at 5. Somebody's got to come out with the tax on the $2 million. Somebody's got to come out of pocket for $1 million. If the business only has $200,000 and it's short, it's got to liquidate something. and in that liquidation process. And the best funding vehicle typically is really a combination of two factors. One would be life insurance. Life insurance is a great funding vehicle by Key Man Life Insurance to be able to fund that, to be able to transfer that down to the next generation. And the second would be to do the gifting during the lifetime so that that $5 million business, when dad dies and the estate is handed down, perhaps $1 to $2 or $3 million of the dollars has already been transferred.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
As well as the fact that those individuals have been incorporated and groomed for that process.
Exactly. You know, I'm listening to you, and I hear you talk about estate planning, and I hear you talk about insurance, and it's clear that you are, you know, looking at all of the risk management and many aspects of your clients. Is that something that you get involved in? I know Meredith is really known as the quarterback for her clients and their wealth planning. You, as a CPA, do you work closely with their other trusted advisors? Is that the ideal situation for our listeners to know that they should bring their team together?
I think the ideal situation is along the lines of what you said. In fact, I think the ideal situation is when Meredith, a financial advisor, and the CPA and the estate attorney work in tandem,
mm-hmm.
work as a tag team. In fact, I think the best tag teams exist when not all three parties agree.
Great.
I think you have added wisdom and insight that's divulged. And in fact, I would even have to suggest a management team where the three people don't agree.
Right.
Yep.
Is a better tag team than one that does.
Excellent. So our listeners should kind of take heed to that and get their advisors in the room and let them duke it out, and they'll come out a little bit ahead on that.
Exactly. And the advisors will be friends at the end of the day, but there might be a little bit of
difference. Might be a little
just a tad. Yeah. That's great. That's great. You know, we want our show and our site to be a tremendous resource for our listeners. So what we would ask you right now is if you could kind of sum up. You've given some great insights, some great tips. I've learned a lot. I'm sure our listeners have. If you were to want to leave three pieces of wisdom with our audience that they could go back up and they'll be able to go on our side and on your side and review at some point in time, what would be those three key things for them to take away from this?
The three key for me would be to live below your means, mm-hmm. not up to your means, but below.
Mm-hmm.
Know your checkpoints. Which I will say, know when something's out of the ordinary.
Yeah.
Know when you need to get a second opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And don't just get a second opinion. Value that second opinion.
Yeah.
Wisdom, if heard and ignored, is just like wind blowing and making a lot of noise.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the third issue is really to be debt averse. Our society, and again, the resultant doom in the economy that we had over the last year, year and a half, has predominantly been because, in my opinion, acquisition of unfounded, unqualified, inappropriate, ill-extended, ill-acquired debt. And I think the best way to add margins to mitigate your checkpoints is to be debt-averse. I've had CPAs over the years have argued, well, you know, your mortgage interest is tax-deductible. Well, we're not in 100% tax bracket. Mm. So it's my understanding if you do have a $10,000 mortgage, you might save $2,000 to $4,000 depending on your tax bracket, but that means you lost $6,000 to $8,000.
Mm-hmm.
Until we are in 100% tax bracket, I think it's advantageous to remain debt averse.
Let's hope we won't be in a 100% tax bracket world.
John seems so certain of that. It's a little scary. John, it's been great. Information is so helpful. Again, you know, I placed CFOs in family businesses and guided them and their CPAs to make that work together. And I certainly would see from what you've shared that someone would be in good hands with you. If they wanted to call you and reach out to you and get some more information and follow up on anything that you've asked, how would they reach you?
The best way to contact us is either one of two ways. Our website, we have about 25,000 visitors a month. It's hiscpa.com. And our phone number is 770-814-9304. And we don't give out our e-address because we don't want spam.
Yeah. Excellent.
And we're available pretty much around the clock, Like a lot of people in the world, we are very customer savvy, mm-hmm. very customer friendly, and we don't forget who writes our check at the end of the day. I think our whole world has gotten to be a little bit less service orientated and a little bit more bothered mm-hmm. by clients rather than mm-hmm. remembering what a client is and who's paying the way.
Mm-hmm. Excellent.
Thanks for coming out, John. We appreciate you.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, some of what you touched on, we're going to continue this conversation with our next show. Next Thursday at 1 o'clock, we'll have Sarah Burden on, and Sarah is with Walden Business. Sarah is really a master of selling businesses, does some work in terms of buying, but her real focus and expertise is on selling business. And, you know, we often hear people say, but I thought my business was worth so much more. And so Sarah is going to come on to hopefully help them not have to say that. So it'll kind of dovetail on a lot of what you said and forming value. And, you know, Meredith and I are thrilled that all of you were listening today. You can this recording of this session will be up on our site at Family Business Radio. Help me, Lee. Family Business Radio.
BusinessRadioX.com.
Thank you. Our contact information is up there too, and we welcome you reaching out to us in any way, shape, or form.
Thank you.
Thank you.